Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. It's a great privilege to be able to introduce to you David Martin, who is the author of a new, very remarkable book called The Assassination of James Forrestal. It just came out. I made the mistake of opening it up as soon as I got it in the mail. I couldn't put it down until it was over. So be careful. I'm very interested in James Forrestal, and I'm just thrilled that Dave could join us today. So Dave, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Well, it's my pleasure.
So you are a researcher, you are an author, you have an extraordinary background in diving in and understanding history. How did that all come about? Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, my minor in college was history, but my major was economics. I figured it'd be better to make a living with an economics degree. I taught school for a year because they gave me a year to report to the Army. I was an ROTC. And I did 2 years in the Army. I was in Korea during the Pueblo incident. And I went on to grad school at the University of North Carolina. I got a PhD in economics and taught economics for 6 years at North Carolina Wesleyan College, working on my dissertation. Took me about 4 years to finish it up because it gave me a heavy teaching load. And after that, I went off to a job in Puerto Rico working for the Economic Development Administration, trying to put a lot of what I had learned into practice. But I soon found among the politicians in Puerto Rico, the old saying that they use economists like the trunk uses a lamppost for support, not for illumination. So, hey, my economist says, but they've already decided what they're going to do, you know, usually for political reasons and not for any rational reasons. So I was an ornament, you know, in my economist. And I escaped from there up to after 4 years in San Juan to work for the governor's office in Washington, Puerto Rico governor's office. And that was the heart of my career for about 15 years. And I finally lost out on the politics as there wasn't a change in administration, but there was an election. And I was more connected to the facts and within the party in power that wasn't in power, if you follow me, the facts. And so after that election, I was out and unemployed for more than a year, actually, working on that other stuff on the side. And anyway, got a nice job at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and rounded out my career in the last 10 years working for the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics in there. Foreign economics section, comparative foreign economics, and that section after I left had been eliminated in the Obama budget cuts.
Well, you could learn a lot there.
If you go on my website, you'll see in my checkered career, I've run across and had a lot of direct experiences, you know, like the guy that had a public relations for Puerto Rico. I had an office right next to me, and I found out actually the day he died that he was a longtime CIA officer.
Right. They're threaded throughout all the agencies.
Oh, yeah. Operation, I have an article that explains, nobody's really picked up on it, but Puerto Rico's Operation Bootstrap was a brainchild of CIA, not who they right. say it was.
Right. Right.
And the CIA can't publicly take credit for it. That's one of their big successes that they can't take credit for. But just from knowing this guy, Scott Runkel.
So it's easy to understand how I picked up on Forrestal because I looked at his oil portrait for years and years and years and heard the stories. But what was it that got you initially interested in James Forrestal?
The Vince Foster case.
Ah, that's right. Okay.
Yeah, the Vince Foster case. Foster was 2 years behind me at Davidson College in North Carolina. We were I didn't know him, but he was the president of his fraternity. I was one of the few people that wasn't. I was then independent and have been independent ever since. And everything. And anyway, the fact that, you know, that he was a Davidson graduate, and he was living in Washington, and when it happened, I'd also become, after the JFK the movie came out, it renewed, intensified my interest in the Kennedy assassination. So then I had this intensified interest in the Kennedy assassination. On the heels of that, here comes this Foster death. The news media coverage reminded me so much of the Kennedy assassination. Now they're trying, the news media all together is just trying to sell you one story.
Right.
And nobody's actually doing any critical reporting, you know? Nobody even went out to Fort Marcy Park.
Right. And the story is clearly just yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the Foster case, and if you want to learn the ins and outs of that, go to FBICoverUp.com.
FBICoverUp.com. Okay.
That is the first and last word. Well, okay. You know, I got to meet people like Christopher Ruddy, who's now a big shot in the media.
Right.
You know, I work very closely with Ruddy. Right. And I have the complete expose article of Christopher Ruddy, who's very close to Donald Trump.
So how did you make this skip from Forrestal to, from Foster to Forrestal? Yeah.
If you follow the Foster case, and many times you see it repeated, the highest level government official to take his own life since James Forrestal. I read regularly. I commuted into work. Took me an hour and 25 minutes public transportation, bus and subway. So I didn't want to waste the time, and I always read a book going in, and sometimes coming back. Usually a little bit too tired to be reading the book coming back, but so I'm reading constantly. I read the McCullough biography of Truman. That really was the first time I heard anything about Forrestal, and McCullough, you know, just says routinely, talks about his decline and his suicide and jumping out of the window at the Tufts Naval Hospital. I took that as fact as I read it, but then the Foster case comes along, and I'm seeing Forrestal referenced in wait a minute, I know that Foster didn't take his own life. maybe they're not telling me the truth about Forrestal either. You know, a very fateful incident occurred. A regular haunt of mine is a used bookstore in Centerville, not far from where I live. And they since moved on to Manassas for cheaper rent, a little farther out. But, so I'm a haunting this used bookstore, and I run across the biography of Walter Winchell. I'm a little older than you. You may not have listened to
it. So Walter Winchell was the smear artist. He and Drew Pearson were the ones who really ran the PSYOP on
it. I come from a traditional Southern liberal family, and Daddy used to listen to the Sunday night programs by Drew Pearson and Walter Winchell, and we all loved Drew Pearson, the liberal, and we hated Walter Winchell, the conservative. That's what we were supposed to do, you know?
Right.
But I remember telling, when I found that book by Neil Gabler, the biography of Walter Winchell, when I bought the book, I told the sales clerk, I said, this book could be dangerous in my hands. The conservative and the liberal had both ganged up on Forrestal. What's this about?
Yeah, because they're not liberal and conservative. They're on the payroll. So let me just describe James Forrestal. The reason I originally got focused on Forrestal, he had come out of Princeton. He was basically a poor boy. He came out of Princeton and very smart, got an entry-level position at Dillon Reed and worked his way up to president by 1937, which I have to tell you, Dave, at Dillon Reed, that's an extraordinary feat. So Dillon Reed was still at that time owned by the Dillon Trust, and you weren't going to get to be the president unless you were. Pretty amazing. And Forrestal had a reputation of being very smart and extremely hardworking and very conscientious. And then he went to become Secretary of the Navy during World War II, and he's the one, he's very close to Bernard Baruch and the group that did the sort of manufacturing and sort of pivoting with the private sector, but he's the one who really built up the Navy and made a major contribution to our winning World War II, and that was when the Navy was a cabinet-level position. So the Department of Defense didn't exist, and then after the war, I'll just say it real quickly, there's a whole bunch of big secret shenanigan things going on that we've all read about. And given that he was in that position and had done a great job on World War II, he would have been in the middle of everything. So I doubt there was a secret in the U.S. government or that touched the U.S. government that he didn't know. And he was instrumental in helping to write the 47 Act that then created the Department of Defense. And he became the first secretary of the Department of Defense. Then it was called Secretary of War, and then it got changed. So this guy was right in the middle of every secret during the war, after the war, the creation of the 47 Act. And it was after that, but immediately 3 weeks before the CIA Act, that this guy basically gets smeared, drummed out, and then basically smeared as unstable, and then basically gets assassinated, and is, you know, of course, everybody's trying to say it is suicide, which is, but I would say that Forrestal, since World War II, is the number one most smeared government official and patriot in this country. Would you say that's fair?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's a close race. The other one is a lot more famous. Senator Joe McCarthy.
Yeah.
Wisconsin.
And I think it was basically the similar team that killed them both.
Yeah, at a similar place.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's real funny because I've studied the Kennedy assassinations very closely. And if you look at the sort of the governance and the chain of command on the Kennedy assassinations, it's very similar. I mean, I think what you've got is you've got the creation of a secrecy infrastructure, and anybody who is for transparency and against building this very expensive, elaborate secrecy infrastructure, you know, they took out.
Yeah. I'm not so sure the comparison of McCarthy and Forrestal works completely, because I'm certain that Forrestal was a fairly genuine guy.
Right.
McCarthy may have been a convenient stooge, you know, because he really didn't show a lot of interest in anti-communism initially as a senator. And it looks like the pro-communist journalist George Stokowski kind of created him, and he was set up to fail, you know.
Right.
And of course, they put these guys like Roy Cohn and G. David Shine around him, who almost made certain that he failed.
Right.
You know, they did the outrageous stuff that was embarrassing to him.
Right.
And but he was in over his head, really.
Right.
Whereas Forrestal was not in over his head. He was too good a man to be in.
So, but I don't think Forrestal really understood the way and the severity with which they would come after him. I think he was a little bit stunned. And one of my questions
I'm still being stunned. My latest discovery, the article I'm working on right now, is based upon what a longtime correspondent of mine who's read the book and she's going hog wild and finding new stuff. It looks like to me that his top aide, Mark Leva, who I trusted implicitly and quote him pretty extensively in the book, was his number one Judas Iscariot, unfortunately.
Who was that? Actually,
Mark Leva, L-E-V-A,
uh-huh.
who... Yeah. I mean, the story that he tells of the breakdown, that's going to be the title of the article that I'm working on. James Forrestal's, quote, breakdown. It's hogwash.
Right, so they tried to persuade everybody that he had had a nervous breakdown, and he hadn't.
Well, the actual details of what supposedly transpired, I took it directly from Leva's Truman Library oral history interview in 1969. And so, I mean, he was there on the spot, you know, and he buys a lot of credibility because he's critical of Navy psychiatry. He's critical of quite a few things, but what his account of the actual what happened the day that the breakdown, right, it corresponds roughly with what the biographer Arnold Rogoff said in 1963. But then when you think about it, you know, 6 years that book had been out. That book was to sell the suicide thesis.
Right.
You know, Leva knew that he couldn't say anything that contradicted what was out in the book.
Right.
But anyway, this is the news, the bombshell. This is a little breaking on this program here, but it's going to be in my article. My correspondent has found a news clipping that said that after his being given his honors up on Capitol Hill, he was going down to Hobe Sound in Florida for a long vacation.
Right.
Well, the story of Leva and Rogo and Hoops and Brinkley in their biography, that decision was supposedly a spur-of-the-moment decision the next day.
Right.
But it's all being reported in the newspaper.
Right.
It's, what the heck?
Right.
It was not a spur-of-the-moment decision.
Well, it would be extremely typical for someone like Forrestal, when leaving office, to go take a long break in Hope. Hope sounds pretty wonderful. You don't go there for a breakdown. You go there to have fun.
Yeah, but I mean, and if you look back at their account, it doesn't make any sense, you know?
Right.
Traveling is stressful. And where even is for just the trip itself is going to be a little bit stressful.
Well, let me step back, because you have tremendous knowledge, but the listeners don't sort of have the chronology. Let me step back and give some of the chronology. So we know Truman, thanks to your good research, Truman came to Eisenhower and he said, I want Forrestal out. Now, we're not quite clear why he wanted him out, but we know he wanted him out. We'll talk about the controversies later.
That was just pure accident that I learned that. You know, that was an invaluable
factoid. But so we know.
I had gone to a meeting up here on the presidential library system, a presentation, and David Eisenhower was speaking, the grandson.
Right.
And I wanted to use the occasion to publicize my Forrestal work, you know, if there was a question from the audience. And uh-huh. After that time, I had received the official report and I'd had it put on a CD. And I gave it to these several library directors, you know, to hope they'll do something with it. Actually, the only person who ever did anything with it was the head of the C.D. Mudd Library at Princeton, the manuscript library, put it up on their website.
There are three things you did that I think have made a tremendous difference in trying to dig out what happened. One is you got the official Navy investigation. It took three FOIAs, and you finally got the Navy to produce the official investigation, which is very, very revealing and certainly does not support any case for suicide. That's number one. Number two, you picked up the factoid about Truman and Eisenhower. And number three, I think you've done an incredible job of getting of interviewing what I would describe the low level people involved. You've interviewed his driver. You interviewed the nurses, the orderlies, or you got their interviews. And what's interesting is, right, they're not paid and they're not involved in fake stories. They're just doing their job.
The latest thing is just a few months ago, I got this email from the daughter of the key witness.
Right. I read that. I read your description that, of that.
That really just blows everything away, because the Hoops and Grinkley use his account supposedly to support the suicide story.
But his daughter, you do a very good job. He lived
in fear for his life because of what he knew.
Right. You do a very good job in the book of showing sort of how they engineered this fake story, fake news. You know, but then it pulls apart as you begin to look at the specific facts of the different people who were being the nurse or being the orderly or being the driver.
Well, they never told you. They never told you who the floor nurse was. They never gave her name.
Right.
We'll find out later that she'd been sent off the halfway to the South Pacific to Guam afterwards. The driver was sent off to Guantanamo.
Right.
You know, to get them far away. And their names are never mentioned. And the one name in the report, this guy, Edward Price, they misspell his name just like they misspell the name of the floor nurse.
Right. That's typical.
Does read that. They won't be able to track him down.
Right. Right. That's a typical. They do that a lot. They play that game a lot on FOIAs as
well. They misspell. This is where we got into that, back to the Foster case. The key witness in that, Patrick Knowlton, the Park Police spelled it N-O-L-T-O-N, and they gave a wrong phone, the wrong address and phone number in their report.
So let's take a look. Let's take a look at why, who would want Forrestal out and why. So let me just bring up two items. One of the things you point out is how controversial his opposition to the creation of the State of Israel was. And what's interesting is if you look at when Israel, you know, declared statehood, then had the war, and then got UN nation, you know, statehood, membership in the UN, that was all done before he was murdered. So, but there's no doubt that he had been very opposed.
Well, that's definitely what got him smeared, for sure. That's the big thing that Pearson and Winchell had in common.
Right.
You know, one was practically a pro-communist. Pearson and Winchell was a fierce anti-communist.
But
they were both Zionists.
But if you look at what he said about the dangers of permitting the creation of the State of Israel, you know, he maps out why this is very bad for U.S. interests. And if you look at some of the descriptions you give in your book, it turns out he was dead right.
Prescient in every way.
Right.
I mean, it shows you. About.
Right. It shows you his brilliance. Because remember, this is a man who understands the world of money, you know, better than any Secretary of Defense in the history of this.
Well, you should know that.
Right. Absolutely. He. There's nothing about the money he didn't understand. And if you look at anyway, so I thought you did a great job of sort of describing his positions there and why. You know, why that was such a problem.
Yeah, but he was hardly alone in the U.S. foreign policy establishment within the government. They all opposed this because for the same reasons. The difference, you point out one big difference that he had. The other big difference is he was fearless and was much more outspoken.
Right.
George C. Marshall didn't get where he was at the top of the army without knowing how to go along to get along. You know?
Right.
And so, I mean, he was just as opposed as Forrestal was, but he wasn't nearly such a lightning rod. He kept his head down publicly.
Well, Forrestal was a very courageous man. Very courageous. That's my impression, and certainly that's the impression I got from working at Dillon Read. You know, you wonder what does it say about a man that many years after his death, you know, 50 years after his death, they still have the portrait high, you know, very prominently in the partner's dining room. It's pretty amazing.
And also 50 years after his death, certain people are still vilifying the hell out of him. People like Aarons and Loftus in their book, The Secret War Against the Jews, you know.
Well,
they have
Let's turn to the CIA Act, because the CIA Act was passed. Forresta was killed on May 22nd, 1949. The CIA Act was passed approximately 3 weeks later, and several things happened with the passage of the CIA Act. First of all, the power of the Dulles brothers skyrocketed, because one of the things that happened was, both through Truman and Eisenhower, they got control of all the assets seized at the end of World War II. And that put them in the banking business covered by enormous secrecy. You know, so complete secrecy, the ability to do covert operations combined with the biggest slush fund in the world, including, you know, because the Dulleses were very, very close to Wall Street. So if you look at what was going on with the Exchange Stabilization Fund and moving that money in, it gave them wide latitude to manipulate in financial currency, global markets worldwide. So you're talking about creating the most powerful secret banking operation in the world. And when you combine what they did with the 49 Act, the CIA Act, is they gave the CIA the ability to claw money out of all the other agencies. And if you take the powers of the 47 Act combined with the 49 Act, you know, you basically take the Dulles brothers, Sullivan and Cromwell, and that whole group that started the CIA, and they become the most powerful operation in the world.
Yep.
Now, what did Forrestal do to threaten that?
We don't have to guess about that. He threatened a lot of things. He also knew about the tremendous infiltration of the government by the communists. You know, the things that M. Stanton Evans has written about, sort of around, kind of like Cornell Simpson has written about the Forrestal death. They're both limited hangout books, I would say.
Right.
Yeah, and it's good stuff. I mean, I reviewed M. Stanton Evans' work on my website.
Now, you said two of the people you mentioned that I wanted to ask you about were Stuart Symington and Ferdinand Eberstadt,
yeah.
You know, when I read your description of his last interaction with Symington, I said, I wonder if Symington poisoned him. Because in times like this, when you're trying to persuade people that somebody's unstable or crazy, it's very typical, including at that time, that they would poison them.
Well, you know, something else I picked up on, if he did have that radical change of behavior, the only thing that makes any sense is somebody slipped something into his drink.
Right.
There's something else my correspondent has discovered. It's a news clip of Forrestal at the White House ceremony on March 28th. He looks as normal as can be. He's smiling. None of these written descriptions of this wasted away guy who's just going out of his mind. No, he was perfectly normal looking.
Right.
So
right.
If he had a radical change in behavior, it could only have been because of something that slipped in his drink.
Right.
And then I discovered that in the Wilcox report, they note, among other things, you know, upon his admission into Bethesda Naval Hospital, that the pupils of his eyes are contracted. But they don't say that there's any blood test. Well, I did a little medical research, and I found that that's a symptom of having barbiturates in your system.
Right.
How about that? You know, right. why were the people's eyes contracted? Well, he's got a drug in his system that's doing that.
Right.
I couldn't find any other explanation. But they make nothing out of it. They just state it and move on.
Well, you know, during my litigation, I was poisoned repeatedly, and some of them were just to sort of scare you or to, you know, knock you off your game. One of them was very life-threatening, I believe. So, but what I did is I started to research what is, you know, because I was stunned at how sort of common it seemed as a tactic and how clever, because it's all very invisible. And there was, you know, they were trying to make me out to be unstable, et cetera, et cetera. So I went back and did a tremendous amount of reading and research, and it's so common. It's such a common tactic, and yet, you know, most people just are not aware.
When somebody's going to testify in court?
Right. Exactly.
Well, it would be, wouldn't it? I hadn't right. thought about that.
Right.
But that's a pretty good way to make somebody appear to be unreliable.
Exactly. Exactly. Or forgetful or tired or, you know. Oh, yeah, no, it was, and it was done repeatedly.
And I guess you've been involved in cases where tons of money were at stake. So if tons of money were at stake, all's fair.
Well, but think about it. When you replace Forrestal and you get the 49 Act, then you control, basically you control the whole overt economy and the whole covert economy. I mean, it makes you the most powerful people in the world, and that's exactly what happened. And if you look at how much money, you know, secret non-taxable money that you can basically print, I mean, that's the most valuable money in the world.
The Lord Act dictum comes into play, and power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Well, tell me a little bit about Eberstadt, because I don't understand what his role was. I know he was down in Hope Sound when Forrestal got down there.
Well, he was a guy that supposedly was on the spot when Leva discovered after that ride back from Capitol Hill in Simonton's car, and Leva discovers Forrestal back at the Pentagon into some kind of trance almost.
I think Symington poisoned him is what it looks like to me.
And this is something that they blow way out of proportion. Forrestal calls for his car to take him home. I said, well, but he didn't realize he's no longer a government official, so he doesn't have a car.
Right.
Well, whose fault is that? Is that an indication that he's nuts? Ridiculous. Government
right.
car drove him to work. How did they expect him to get home?
Right.
You know, that they would make something of that shows that they're reaching.
Right.
He should have had a car. That's the Pentagon's fault if he didn't have a car.
Well, but here's the thing. If you want to smear a guy like Forrestal, what you do is you know, it's like throwing mud on the wall. You just do thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of things.
Throw everything, anything that'll stick. Yeah.
Well, it won't stick, the more you can throw, you know, everybody says, well, there's smoke, there's fire, even though.
Yeah,
you know,
well, then Eberstadt is stationed at Wall Street, but he had to be in town to do some testimony, as they say. And Leva calls Eberstadt, which is, what should we do with it? Leva's account, if you look at my account, he's very confused, but they end up meeting, coming together at the Georgetown home of a Forrestal, and the interesting thing is Eberstadt and Upson Brinkley, of course he was dead at the time, Upson Brinkley, well, he died in 69, but Rogo wrote his book in 63. Eberstadt is never quoted directly, but you got things in Rogo's book that could have only come from Eberstadt.
So let me ask you something. Eberstadt, was it Dylan Reed? Where was Eberstadt? Was Eberstadt at Dylan Reed?
No, not at Dylan Reed. I don't remember what Wall Street. It wasn't Dylan Reed though. But
okay.
he was with an outfit in on Wall Street, and so I mean, he was either Leva or Eberstadt supposedly made the decision. He needs to go down to Hope Sound. Well, now we know that the decision already been made, which that's a lie,
right?
But Eberstadt didn't contradict it. And another thing, a point that I make in the book, and it gets bigger now with these new discoveries, neither Leva nor Eberstadt nor Robert Lovett, who has the estate down in at Hope Sound in Florida that they go to, and then none of these people that are supposedly so close to Forrestal, none of them visited him in the 7 weeks he was with us at the Naval Hospital.
Well, they weren't allowed. They wouldn't let his brother come in.
Yeah, but it's not that they wouldn't let them. They chose not. You know, there's nothing in the record that said that they were denied.
Well, his brother said he was denied access to him.
Oh, the brother was. The brother would have been, but these other people chose not to.
So let me just bring up some dates, because Eberstadt started his career at Dillon Reed, and then in 1931 he created his own firm.
Uh-huh.
But he would have, if you look at what he did and how he did it, he would have remained close. He was also a Princeton graduate. He would have remained close to Dillon. Now, Dillon was the chairman of Dillon Reed at that point. So you have Douglas Dillon.
Yeah. Oh, he's definitely the biggest things, yes.
Okay, now, Douglas Dillon and the Dillons were unbelievably close to the Dulles brothers. And what's interesting, and this is why I thought the factoid on Eisenhower was so important, when Eisenhower runs for president, Dillon basically organizes and delivers New Jersey, and then as soon as Eisenhower is in, he becomes ambassador to France. So something created a very close, intimate connection between Dillon and Eisenhower, with Eisenhower being grateful to Dillon. And my question is, if Truman asked Eisenhower to get rid of Forrestal, did Eisenhower turn around and get Douglas Dillon to help?
And Eberstadt as well, probably.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, because basically what you saw with the 49 Act was the takeover of Wall Street, creating the CIA so that the military wouldn't control, and moving the biggest slush fund in the world to the CIA. And, of course, we know that Eisenhower got furious at the CIA. One of my favorite Eisenhower stories, which I believe is true, is he put the CIA in charge of Area 51. They refused to brief him or report or keep him up to date, and he finally called them one day and told them that if they weren't in his office with a full briefing the next morning, he was going to fly to Colorado, get the First Army, and invade Area 51.
Wow.
And so the next day they were in his office, yeah. Well, but I think he turned over, you know, Eisenhower got used. He turned over the keys to the kingdoms to the CIA, and it was a huge Wall Street end run around the military. And I think they needed to get Forrestal out of the way to engineer it. That's what it looks
like
to me.
Yeah, just pure happenstance, you know. At this conference and afterwards, I'm talking with Mike Levine, the head of the Truman Library, who's actually a long-term family friend of mine, believe it or not. And his wife and mine are very close. And David Eisenhower up in the front of the room, and Eisenhower just says offhand, because you know my grandfather was tasked with the job of pushing Forrestal out, and
right.
I raised my eyebrows at that, pushing Forrestal out, what, you know, it's like out the window. And we have a laugh about it because I really knew that's not what he meant, but. Eisenhower, I didn't make it. It didn't add up to me.
Right.
You know? What did Eisenhower have to do? But it would have added up to you, I guess.
Well, it's extraordinary. If you look at the death, in fact, Forrestal was thrown out of the window. Was it the 16th floor?
16th floor, landing
16th
on
floor.
A third floor
and,
roof.
And it was thrown out at sort of 1 o'clock or 2 a.m.
in
the morning.
About 2 a.m., yeah.
About 2 a.m. And he had a bathrobe cord tied around his neck tightly. And
they implied that it was on bathrobe cord, but they never located his actual bathrobe. He was not wearing a bathrobe. He was in his pajamas.
Right, and so it looks like they were trying to strangle him, and he fought them. And the next thing
well,
you know,
broken glass on the bed and at the foot of the bed on the floor. And there's a photograph of the broken glass at the foot of the bed.
Right. If you look at the evidence, and you do a great job of really documenting this all out. If you look at the evidence, in no way this guy committed. I mean, the evidence alone with the broken glass and the cord and everything else. I mean, it their whole story makes no sense. And I think it's a perfect example of if you can tell a lie strong enough for a long enough and scare people. I mean, if you look at the Navy's own investigation, which was kept secret, it is clear that there is no one on that on that group who did the investigation who thinks Forrest Hill killed himself, but they don't want to get killed either.
Yeah. Well, right. like Edward Price's daughter said, you know, he lived in fear for his life for the rest of his life, or right. what he knew.
Right.
And I mean, it's so preposterous. They want to tell us that he was using that bathrobe cord tied to the radiator to hang himself out of the 16th floor window. Is that not overkill? Like, he didn't know that just all he needed to do was a swan dive out the window, and that would pretty well do it.
Here's the thing. Whatever Forrestal was, he was a very, very smart man. If he was going to kill himself, he could come up with, you know, a more logical sequence.
And furthermore, you know, the orderly is supposed to come back any second. He's supposed to be in a hurry to get himself killed, so he takes the time to tie this thing around his neck, and former Navy man is such a bad knot tire that it somehow comes loose.
So if you look at Forrest Hill in Bethesda Naval Hospital, one of my questions is, he's clearly under house arrest. He's clearly not crazy. He's clearly not unstable. They've got him under a house arrest. The question is why? And I think it's because they're trying to get all the politics done to get, you know, to get the CIA Act passed, and they don't want him talking to anybody. So they can't even afford, you know, for him to be in Hope Sound, because then he could talk to people. So they want him literally
except
under
for the
house
people
arrest.
That are safe for him to talk to. Even young Senator Lyndon Landslide Johnson
right.
goes to visit him very right. much against his wishes.
Right.
What was that about?
Well, I'll tell you what that is about. If they're trying to get the CIA Act passed and these different sort of secrecy infrastructure put in place, they need some of his information to help them do it. So they're trying to figure out how to get the opposite policy done that he wants, and they've got to apply him for information. And then, of course, if they visit him, they can say, "Oh, well, I talked to Forrest Hill, and he supports this." You know, that's why if you're in a situation like Forrest Hill's, you want to refuse to meet with any of those guys, because if they meet with you, then they can tell people you said things you didn't say, and everyone will believe them because, in fact, you did meet with them. It's an old Washington trick. I had one of D'Amato's guys as my undersecretary. I was Hutton. He taught me all these tricks. Each one was a painful lesson, but I learned them. So if these guys ever got you in lock and key, refuse to meet with anybody who doesn't have integrity, because you think they can't hurt you.
You wouldn't be meeting with anybody.
So let's talk about what were the policies aside from Israel, because that one's sort of zero and one.
Well, I mean, you look at all the people that have got killed related to the Israel issue. That seems to be pretty sufficient, you know. I mean, the prime UN mediator, Count Folk Bernadotte.
Yeah, but they already had statehood before he died. So Israel had gotten everything they wanted before he died.
They had further ambitions, you know. They continue to have further ambitions. And the things he might have written, the things that, you know, the arm twisting that went on, the blackmail that went on to get enough people to
thing, Dave. If you look at the money involved with the Dulles Group and the black budget versus Israel, that was a much bigger play. In other words,
it could well have been,
You know, Israel at that time was a small subsidiary of that whole big Dulles Wall Street play.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, if you look at the amount of money you're talking about involved and the profitability of it, you know, if I spend $1 billion in government and, you know, it's worth $100 million of profits, if I make it secret, it can be worth $500 million of profits. So we're talking about, you know, engineering the entire post-World War II global economy and
financial
markets. Well,
that black budget
markets.
Is certainly a big thing. You see my article about my experience with the Gold Warriors book that I had on my Kindle?
Uh-huh.
It's all about the General Yamashita's gold that he had accumulated and hidden in the Philippines, and we apparently found most of it. And that that's the foundation of most of the black budget, and they use it to bribe the key politicians in Japan.
So what I want to know is what were Forrestal's policies that would have gotten him crosswise with all, you know, because Truman came out of the, was it the Kansas or the Missouri mob? You know, basically
Kansas City, Missouri mob, you know. He was eminently blackmailable on account of his mob connections.
Right.
I mean, he was truly a creation of awesome, what's his name?
Well, here's the thing. You had the whole CIA group. So you had the Dulles brothers and that whole infrastructure on Wall Street. And they had made a decision at the end of World War II to open up the U.S. markets to drugs. And that was a partnership with the mob that came out of the, you know, the Italian landings in World War II. So you've got all the mob guys across the country, and you've got the Dulles brothers and the Wall Street mob, and they're in sync to bring in hard narcotics and, you know, and do all this secrecy in the black budget. So what I'm wondering is exactly what did Forrestal do that I can imagine many things, but what did he do that stood in the way of that? Was he against the creation of the CIA? What were his policies?
I have no idea about that. I haven't run across any opposition on his part to the creation of the CIA. And like a lot of people, including Eisenhower, what the CIA morphed into, they never anticipated that.
Right.
But, yeah. Right. But I mean, definitely. That diary of his that he kept, you know, that's a whole other story about the what happened to that. You know,
well, that seems to have been disappeared and edited. I mean, they publish diaries, but they're clearly edited and not the
heavily edited. Now, supposedly the full diaries are on file up at the manuscript library at Princeton, but since it was in the possession of the Truman White House for a very long time, I mean, they may tell you that the full thing's there, but there's absolutely zero reason to believe it, because they're not going to leave things there that are incriminating.
Right. Well, you know, I'm amazed that you were able to get as much as you did. And I think...
Well, it was a miracle that my third try, I got the Wilkes report. And first I jumped through all the proper hoops. I jumped through all the proper hoops to sent a written letter twice to the FOIA officer of the National Naval Medical Center. And by law, they're supposed to respond to you one way or the other by something like 10 business days. Well, they broke the law twice and did not respond to it. Well, I was in contact with John Clark, the lawyer for the foster witness, Patrick Nolan. He's done a lot of FOIA lawsuits. You know, you can represent yourself. It's not very expensive. And that was going to be my next step. I was going to file a FOIA lawsuit. I'm just surfing the net one night, and I run across the Navy JAG office website, and I see they have a little form to fill out if you want to make a FOIA request. So, you know, it took me 10 minutes, and I did it. Lo and behold, about a week later, I get a letter and said, we'll be sending you the Wilkes report.
Oh.
Like that. So I think somebody screwed up.
So here's the thing. Dave, I think that your contribution has been amazing. And it's much more important than I think even you realize. Because if you're going to understand American history in the 20th century, you have got to understand how we morphed, you know, from the end of World War II, from a nation to this huge military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about, and you cannot understand it unless you understand the nuts and bolts engineering. And that includes how a lot of very powerful leaders who wanted to do the right thing were assassinated, of which I think Forrestal's importance and his position, particularly as a former Wall Streeter, is pivotal.
Yeah, he was right in the thick of it, in the heart of it.
And you have to understand, this man was assassinated. And the whole ruse, the whole fake news that he committed suicide is just, you know, it's blown out of the water by your
research. Well, just as
a
case study of fake news, you won't find anything better. By the way, before I forget it, I wanted to contrast the word I've coined with the word you've coined. You call it shriekometer, right?
Right.
The shriekometer.
The shriekometer. Well, they turned the shriekometer on this guy something fierce.
Yes, but I think mine, the NOMA, is better. And I'll explain why.
Okay.
It stands for National Opinion Molding Apparatus, the NOMA. The biggest, the most, I many years ago, based on my experience in the Foster case, I put up something called 17 Techniques for Truth Suppression. Number one, by far, is dummy up.
Right.
If you didn't report it, it didn't happen. It's not news. It didn't happen.
Right.
And that's the opposite of any kind of shrieking. It's unshrieking.
Right.
That is the major method by which opinion is molded.
Right.
By not reporting very, very, very important news like this.
Right. I call it material omission. Right. Material omission. Yeah.
This Wilkins report is like the Warren report. You know, right. I got it and I made it public. Nobody knows it.
Right.
How can you ignore it? If it doesn't exist.
Well, but I think now that you've published this book and you've been able to connect the dots, I was just over meeting with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and I gave him a copy of the book. And in fact, I gave him my copy with all the notes scribbled over it. He just finished a book on Joe McCarthy, including the, you know, sort of the questions around McCarthy's death. And it's clear if you look at the thread of the assassinations from World War II, you know, through the end of, say, 1970, you know, there's a thread that relates to this secrecy infrastructure. Now, I'm not saying, you know, it's all the same people, but I think, you know, if you look at who killed Forrestal, I'll bet you a dollar it's the same exact team, sort of governance and senior management that killed Kennedy.
Oh, yeah. So, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, on this continuity, let me give you a poem of mine that I wrote on the 40th anniversary of JFK's assassination. 40 years and counting since Kennedy was killed, and our vacuum of leadership still has not been filled. Why should those shoes present such difficulty in filling? The candidates were weeded out by those who did the killing.
Right. Exactly.
And that's it. You know, I mean, the presidents are weeded out. And once they slip through and get in, I mean, the son of this Mick Bob drug dealer turns out to be a little more honest than they thought he was going to be.
Right.
And so you got to get rid of him.
Right. You know, and this is how we end up with all criminals running the country.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So our time is coming to a close. I want you to talk about how we get the book, because I think this is
marvelous. Right now, the only way to get it is through Amazon. Just go to Amazon and order it there. I hate to enrich Jeff Bezos, but we're working on the other to get it in bookstores. But.
So it's called The Assassination of James Forrestal by David Martin. It's an outstanding example of fake news and character assassination and the power of it. So, and it's a very, very important part of American history. So now
it's
tell us about your
learn.
Website. Absolutely.
Yep.
Tell us about your website.
DCDave.com. Most of it's there. It's just not as well organized as in the book. It's just scattered all over the place. But let me give a plug for this other guy, AriWatch.
Okay.
He's the only other person that's done any significant research in the Foster case. He uses a pseudonym of Mark Hunter, but that's not his real name. He lives down in Charlottesville, and I've never met him, never talked to him on the phone or anything.
Now, what's his website again?
It's for the Ayn Rand Research Institute Watch, AriWatch, A-R-I-W-A-T-C-H. But if you go to the James Forrestal Wikipedia page, you'll see that in the notes at the bottom, there's a link to the HTML searchable form of the Wilcox Report with commentary that he's put on his website.
Oh, wonderful.
I talk about it in the book a little bit, but he's added some things that that I don't have in the book or even on my website. So he's the only other person that's made a significant contribution. So you can go to his, just read the commentary on his searchable form of the Wilcox Report. And I mean, the researchers, he's made it a lot easier. You can just plug in a name or like nervous breakdown. You put in the word nervous, and you said the doctors never mentioned any nervous breakdown.
Well, you're having an impact because at Wikipedia, they say the cause of death is accidental or intentional fall, possibly suicide.
Yeah.
So, no, they don't say suicide. You got to back. This is how it works with the Shriek community. You just got to back them up. So, Dave, it's really been a pleasure to meet you, to know you, to read your book. And I cannot thank you enough for your contribution. I think it's...
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah.
I just think you make the bad guys look like what they are.
Yeah. Well, I'm just learning new bad. I didn't realize Mark's level was one of the bad guys. But it's like, was it Harry Truman that said, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog?
Touche. Touche. So, Dave Martin, thank you for joining us on the Salera Report. You have a great day.
Okay. Okay, thanks a lot. Okay, bye.